Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Allison Hawthorne Deming, writer, poet, and Regents Professor at the University of Arizona. We're talking about her new book, A Woven World, on fashion, fishermen, and a sardine dress. Allison, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much, Mark. I'm very happy to be with you today.
Would you say this is a memoir?
This book is hard to describe. I think it's partly a memoir, as you know. It's partly a memoir. It's partly a cultural history. My joke to myself was, it's a cultural memoir, because I get tired of memoirs that are too self-obsessed.
Yeah,
and
this isn't that. This is not
story.
That. The reason I ask is these are one of those unique books that are singular, that there's no other book like that. And at one point I go, this is what happens when a poet writes a memoir.
Yeah, well, that's basically it. You've got the sense of the book because you know how a poem can digress into wonderful directions and follow images and music of the language, and I like to do that in prose as well.
There's numerous side trips in this book, and some of them are just, I mean, I learned so much about crinoline.
You never thought crinoline could be so interesting, did you?
I want you to write the entire history of crinoline. That and Weirs on Grand Manan. Oh, my God.
Yep.
Okay, but this is a history that begins with a sardine dress. I want you to describe that dress, because that dress captured my imagination.
Well, I saw this dress at the Costume Institute at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It's a dress that was designed by Yves Saint Laurent, and he didn't call it the sardine dress. That name attached to it because, of course, it makes a woman's body look like a sardine. It's this sheath that clings to the skin, and it's all embroidered with sequins, just layered over one another so that it shines like the scales of a fish. And it's very elegant. It's not super sexy. You know, it's not low cut, no slit up the thigh or anything. But it really is a celebration of kind of biomorphic beauty and equating almost a woman to the beauty of a fish and its agility.
And therein, the book goes wild.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to be reading one thing, and I ended up reading a bunch of things. There are two main threads in this book, and they're all about making and creating as opposed to destroying and unmaking.
Yeah.
And those are the overarching themes that keep getting interwoven themselves in the book. And talk to me how you feel about that. I mean, this is a heartfelt book about the importance, the cultural importance, the personal importance of making things.
Yes. Yes, thank you. Well, my working title was Lament for the Makers, which was after W.S. Merwin and others who've used that phrase, and the sadness about losing so many trades and arts that have to do with the human skill of making with our hands. And, you know, the idea of making has a metaphoric resonance for our time. It's a time when so much is being unmade. The natural world is being unmade. Here in the United States, the sense of democratic principles and civic discourse is being unmade. The sense of a future we can count on is being unmade. So it's a very destabilizing time. And not to mention the pandemic, which is making us feel that our health is being unmade in ways we never anticipated. So what do we do about that? You know, there's a tremendous feeling of elegy, of course, of sadness, fear, and anxiety that attaches to all of those changes. But on the other hand, it calls attention to how good human beings have been at making things, and that meaning attaches to the things that we make by hand, maybe sometimes with the help of some machines. I'm not against machines. I don't want to go back to the Pleistocene. But making is a beautiful part of being a human being. And, of course, one needs to be mindful about what one is making. One can make plastics and nuclear bombs, and I'm not in favor of too much of either of those things.
But those things contribute to unmaking, too.
Yeah, they do. And what are the things, you know, I ask myself, I ask others to think about, what are the things in your family or cultural tradition that are celebrations of banking, where there are skills that might be fading away out of the world that you would want to call up and say, let's pay attention to this. Is this something we should hold from the past and treasure from the past and maybe adapt it to future use as we deal with, you know, this time of great change and unmaking?
This is a book also about history, and that's where the making comes in, is that these traditions of making go back in time, and it may be through your family, it just may be through the culture.
Yeah.
And it seems like at this time, and I can't remember another time where people are just ignorant of our history and don't want to change their preconceived ideas of what our history is.
Exactly. Well, I don't know why that is. Part of it is that the way we look at history too often is highly politicized, and you have to take a side, one side or the other, and you have to get into an argument if you talk about history. And that's one way of thinking about it. But in this book, I looked at, you might think, two kind of backwaters of cultural history. One, these fishermen on this small island of Grand Manan in the Canadian Maritimes, where I've been coming since I was a kid, who build these beautiful weir structures off the shore of the island for catching herring. This is an adaptation of Aboriginal weirs that, of course, gone on for thousands of years in the Americas, maybe 8,000 years in the British Isles and Scandinavia. So it's an old tradition that's been made for here. But it's not a celebrity maker tradition, herring weirs, but it's beautiful. And the same with the dressmaking and the fashion in this book. My grandmother and great-grandmother were both dressmakers and had a small salon in New York City making those high-end fashions for the, you know, wealthy in the Gilded Age. And small woman-run business, women of great skill, sometimes immigrants employed a Hungarian woman who was the beater for them.
Yeah.
You know, these are small cultures that take us back into history, into some of the ways people have found to survive that gave them a sense of community, meaning, belonging, you know, and sustaining themselves and their families. So history isn't just the wars and politics and what we have to argue about. History is also, you know, what are the beautiful things that people have done on a smaller scale that worked and that fit perfectly their time and place? And what are some of those skills that might fit perfectly our time and place? That's a question I want to hold out, you know, for myself and everyone, really.
Let's start by talking a little bit. And obviously, I don't want to give away a lot of stuff in this book, although it's going to be a surprise reading because the prose is so well done. But let's talk about herring, because you mentioned weirs.
Yeah.
I think most people don't even know what weirs are.
Right. Well, most people do say weirs. Up here in the Maritimes, they call them weirs. But herring weir or any fish weir is just basically a fish trap. So native people, there's a historic record of a historic weir here from the 1700s, band of Indians. I'm not sure what tribe, probably Maliseet or Mi'kmaq being in this region. Are on a long march, and they find a lot of young salmon playing in a little stream, a little outlet coming into the ocean. And they immediately cut brush and use the brush and blankets to make a fence in the water to trap the salmon. And they catch 54 young salmon right on the spot, dry them over a fire. So this is an old technology. And now up here, for the last 200 years, they've built these structures where they'll just offshore, where the water is shallow enough, they will drive large stakes, maybe 60 feet tall, into the seabed and create this structure that oddly and beautifully is in a heart shape. and then that's topped with birch saplings, and that's strung with twine or netting. And the herring come to shore to feed at night. And when they come to shore, they run into a fence, which is like a stem going from that heart shape to the shore. They run into that fence, and that directs them right into that trap. And there they circle and circle and circle. And then the fisherman goes in and loads them up into a carrier and takes them off to the sardine factory. So it's very crafty. It works very well up here where we have the big tides of the Bay of Fundy.
Now, that's only the beginning of the story. First of all, weirs or wares. Well, it's interesting because outside of Worcester, where I'm talking, we have a town called Ware, W-A-R-E, and originally it was Weir, W-E-I-R. And I think it was to catch the anadromous fish that were coming up the river.
But absolutely, alewives possibly.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yes.
But
yes.
These weirs on Grand Manan, each one has a name, and and they're known as like landmarks. You took a plane a plane tour around just to see the different weirs.
Absolutely. So they're named, some of them are family names, some of them are place names like Pat's Cove or Bradford Cove. Some of them are witty names like the Iron Lady, which was named after Margaret Thatcher. Some of them are biblical. There's the Jubilee. There's one called the Turkish Empire. I have no idea why. But they can be quite witty. And, yes, they're known. Oh, they'll say, yep, somebody got so many hogsheads out of the mumps yesterday. There's one called the mumps.
Now, is there a stone weir?
Well, originally, before there were drivers with diesel engines that could be floated out and drive those big stakes into the ocean, they built a structure using stone in shallow water. And they actually were building a kind of crib work out of timbers. The stone went inside the crib work. Huh. It's like a kind of triangular shaped place where they could put the rocks, and the rocks would be held there from being moved by the tide. And then they could just stick the brush right in those crib works with the rocks inside them. So that would be an easy way to do it when they could walk out and bring their ox carts out there before they were diesel engines and drivers. And then, over time, of course, all of the wooden parts of these structures and the brush would be washed away in the sea, and what would remain would be the stones. And now if you take a small plane out and fly over these shallow passages, you can see these absolutely beautiful structures, the remains of these, what we call the stone weirs that were built in the 1800s and maybe well into the 1900s.
And through weirs, what happens is an entire history of a fish.
Yeah.
Herrings, of which sardines are a type of herring.
Yeah.
So this whole, it ends up the symbol of this this sardine dress, which is woven, as are these weirs. Herring, and most people aren't even familiar with, because who eats herring now?
Sadly,
that used to be the food for Europe and North America. I love the fact that you wrote that they used to be called the Silver Darlings.
Yes, they're called, they have all kinds of names, and particularly in Scandinavia. They were called the Silver Darlings in Scotland, the Silver of the Sea in Sweden. They said Amsterdam was built on herring bones. And herring and sardines were the fish that fed the Industrial Revolution. They're cheap. They could be salted and dried. Even Henry David Thoreau writes of the great barrels stacked on the wharves that he saw filled with salted herring, and that those were, he called them fuel to feed our vital fires.
The potato of the Middle Ages, somebody called it.
Yeah, that's pretty good. The potato. Well, this was, herring have been very abundant. They're one of the most abundant fish in the sea. They're very healthy. They have, of course, protein. They have omega-3s. And because they're low on the food chain, they don't have some of the contaminants like the mercury, et cetera, that we know get into fish higher on the food chain. So they're very, very healthy. Now, most herring caught up here goes to become bait for the lobster fishery.
Oh, wow.
Which I think is terribly sad. Because
it is sad.
This is a fish that it could be fished sustainably because there are so many of them. They're highly adaptive. They can recover if they get overfished, unlike some of the larger fish. So, I'm all for let's have some restaurants that specialize in magnificent ways to use herring and other fish that aren't the celebrity fish like halibut and swordfish, but are healthy, abundant, and sustainable.
You write, I think it's you that wrote in the book, I like food that tells a story.
Yeah. And that for some reason, a lot of stories.
I know. And for some reason, that just stuck in my mind. I like that, too. I like stuff that when you're looking at it on your plate, there's a whole history that sort of flashes before your head.
Yeah, an apple that comes from an orchard you know has
that's
a
right.
lot more story than one that got shipped to you from God knows where.
There's also an amazing poem that's worth the price of admission alone buying this book. Herring our king. And somebody's got to have recorded that somewhere, and I've got to find that recording. But that is a spectacular poem.
I have a song that was performed by a British group called Folly Bridge that is about the herring are the king of the sea. One can Google that. One can Google on YouTube, Herring Are the King of the Sea by Folly Bridge, and it is an awesome song with awesome visuals of the harvesting of herring through periods of history in the British Islands.
You talk about when the herring are being harvested in the weirs, there's this incredible sort of roiling of bright silvery fish.
Yeah.
And it's a very visual delight.
Oh, I'm glad you can see it because it's an amazing experience. It's, you know, it's an experience of great bounty and of course men working, and they're mostly men in this fishery up here. Men working together, usually multi-generations,
yep.
Grandfather, son, grandson, maybe some brothers in any of those generations. And they're all working in a beautifully orchestrated fashion to bring the harvest in. And as the nets that hold the catch are lifted up from the bottom, what they say, it's drying out as the water goes out, and you have this huge net that they'll say, that's a nice bag of fish. And it's just this magnificent silver pool of beautiful creatures. And, of course, it's not beautiful for the herring. It's getting harvested. But there's consolation in knowing that, you know, there are herring shoals that might be 9 miles long and 2 miles wide. There are a lot
wow.
of herring in the sea.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Allison Hawthorne Deming, writer, poet, and Regents Professor at the University of Arizona. We're talking about her new book, which has to be read to be understood, A Woven World on Fashion, Fishermen, and the sardine dress. Did somebody make a bet that you couldn't write a book about fashion and fish?
Kind of. Everybody. I mean, it was a really implausible idea. I at first wanted to write about the women, my grandmother
yeah.
and great-grandmother, because there were no stories about them, these skilled dressmakers. And I was walking. A writer friend came to visit me up here in the Maritimes, and I was walking among the old abandoned smokehouses for where they used to smoke the herring, and I was telling her that was what I was going to work on. But she said, well, wait a minute, what about writing about this herring fishery? You know a lot about this. This is really interesting. I said, oh, no, I have to write about these women and their lost culture. She said, it's the same book. And I thought, ding, ding, ding. You know, it was almost like a dare. Can you write a book about fashion and fishing? And, you know, artists and poets like to take on implausible projects, and I went for it. And, of course, I had great doubts for many years as I was working on this. I did get a Guggenheim Fellowship for this proposal, so that gave me some confidence that I wasn't completely nuts.
Well, let's turn to the fashion side for a bit.
Yeah.
Your grandmother and great-grandmother, Marie Bregne, is that how you pronounce
Brainy.
It?
Brainy.
And her mother, Louisa.
Yes.
Talk to me about Louisa.
Louisa is such a mystery.
I know.
We know a little about her, which is sad. But she was a woman who was a dressmaker for Empress Eugenie in the Second Empire, the wife of Napoleon III. And, of course, Empress Eugenie was one of the great fashion mavens of all time, the one who made the crinoline so popular as any fashion trend that she set became a trend. And so, you know, I knew this about my great-grandmother, how remarkable it was that she had these skills and was in a circle of these, you know, the last wave of the great aristocracy that moved through Europe and in a period of great difference between the wealthy and the poor. And here was Louisa, somewhere in the middle in this maker class, not she herself wealthy or not she herself poor, but certainly on the outskirts of the very wealthy and making the performance of this aristocracy possible with her skills.
Right.
But she left Paris and moved to New York. She had intended, as we were told, to move to Mexico. And this was during the occupation of Mexico in the 1860s by France. But when her ship got to New York, she was told, you cannot go on. It's no longer safe. They're killing the French. And thankfully, the Mexicans said, thank you. We'll take our country for ourselves. And she stayed in New York and managed to establish this business there. Always kept her her French language and her French name. I've seen her stationery, and you know, it was Madame Brainy. And then, of course, her daughter, my grandmother Mary, took it over when she became too old. So I don't know much about her life, and every time I looked for those bits of data that would tell me something like, okay, when did she actually arrive? Look for the ship manifest. When she arrived in New York in the 1860s, the ships were coming into Castle Island. This was before Ellis Island. And records of the travelers who came in there were lost in a fire. I said, okay, let's find her marriage certificate. You know, well, I find a marriage certificate that she was married in New York, and it's like 20 years after all of her children were born. And it's a real marriage certificate. So I can only find mysteries about her. I couldn't find facts.
Traveled to Paris to try to...
I went to Paris hoping I could find something, a birth certificate. But even her name is... Was she Louisa de Saintil or Louisa Dalmont? Different documents say different things. So I at some point I made a turn and said, you didn't want information anyway. You wanted a story. You wanted to know what were the cultural influences that mm-hmm. shaped her life. What was her world like? And so that's why, you know, I say this is kind of a cultural memoir. It's like looking at what was the culture she moved in, both in Paris and then in New York. And that seemed to be, in some respects, a richer story than the data you find, you know, when you find a birth record. Well, great, I have a fact, but a fact isn't a story.
But you tell a lot of stories in this book. And I just want to stick with one or two before we end. Empress Eugenie's crinoline. Crinolines back then were not what people think of crinolines now.
No. They were made of steel hoops and horse hair and linen strips. They were gigantic, and the wealthier you were, the more gigantic they were. They were so beloved that even there is a record of a countrywoman who had no money to get the steel hoops or used an old chicken coop to widen her skirt. But the width, you know, the width of your dress was a signifier of your stature. And so women wanted big, wide dresses. And, it, you know, it just caught on, like whatever the fashion trends are of our time. I don't know. You know, like, well, it caught on like fishnet stockings or whatever.
That's another whole story.
That's another whole story. That's in the book.
Now, the funny thing is when the crinoline sort of faded eventually, people were really happy that it faded. There was a lot of newspaper people who were like celebrating the fact the crinoline is gone.
Yeah, they hated it. They hated it. But I found also there was a column, I think it was in Harper's Bazaar. This is in the book, too. There was a column called The Rise and Fall of the Crinoline, a fashion commentary column. I couldn't believe it, so I named the chapter after that column, and I quote that column there. And the author of that was a man whose name I've forgotten at the moment. It also documented a woman who had said, I don't celebrate the loss of this. I'm going to feel vulnerable and naked without my crinoline. It's like a circle of protection. You know, it keeps unwanted people out of business.
Yeah, it kept the dogs at bay, man, the sleazy guys. You couldn't get close.
That's right. Forget it, dude. I've got my protection.
Now, we literally just have minutes left, but I want to talk about your prom dress.
Oh, well, there are two prom dresses in the book. One awful one from a thrift store that my crafty grandmother remade to make beautiful. And the other one was the one I made myself, which was the hardest thing I ever sewed. But I was determined, my senior year of high school, to make it. And it was a very elegant, sort of a Grace Kelly-ish dress, not a puffy dress like a lot of the girls wore. It was satin. The skirt was a bell-shaped burgundy. The bodice was a pink sleeveless scoop neck. It was a two-tone prom dress, and it really signifies a lot of what I felt like as a teenager, two-toned.
Well, you were you were a rebellious teenager. That initially, you were anti-fashion.
Oh, absolutely. And well into my young adulthood, I was very anti-fashion. I thought it was so capitalistic, so superficial. It reduced women to objects, and I didn't want my stature to be determined by what I was wearing, you know, all that. So I would dress like a bohemian with busted up loafers and a sweater with holy elbows. But
what happened to you?
I know. Well, what happened was I wanted to write about these women. And I thought, I haven't shunned fashion throughout my adult life. I don't mind fashion, but I thought if I want to write about these women, I have to learn something about fashion, and I have to care about fashion. So I took that on as a project, and then I had to think about dresses, you know, throughout my childhood that I might talk about as my early experiences of fashion.
And coats. And I want to mention, don't start talking about them because we're almost out of time. There are two really amazing coats that you had.
Yeah.
That you talk about, a camel and a seal coat.
Yes, camel hair coat and a sealskin coat.
People are going to have to read it to know those stories. And there's so many more stories in this book. This is an entertaining book, and I don't mean that in a bad way. This is an entertaining book. I loved reading it.
I'm so happy. I want this book to be full of surprises for people and to be full of delights for people. So,
but now you've set the bar for your next book.
I'm in trouble now.
You are. My guest tonight has been Allison Hawthorne Deming, writer, poet, and Regents Professor at University of Arizona. And we've been talking about her new book, trust me, this is one that you should read, A Woven World on Fashion, Fishermen, and the Sardine Dress. It's all woven together, trust me. Allison, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.